Welcome to DC EKG, where we diagnose Washington, D.C.'s policy diseases and provide needed prescriptions. I'm Joe Grogan, along with Eric Euland. Today, we're going to do a DC EKG pulse check, just Eric and I talking about the State of the Union and what to expect and a little bit behind the scenes of what goes into a State of the Union. So, Euland, I love this discussion because the State of the Union was probably the highlight of my time working in the White House. I don't think there's anything more exciting for a policy wonk than working with the president and his speechwriters on inserting good, solid policies into the State of the Union and getting to see the speech early and the multiple drafts and how hard the speechwriters are working. Sifting through all the policies. I mean, the first thing that goes out, I mean, in the summer, a call goes out to the cabinet secretary saying, do you have anything that you want to, that you would like to announce in the State of the Union? And that really kind of kicks off the process of winnowing through what policies. And then the staff in the White House, of course, has their own ideas, and there's far more good ideas than you can use. And then being able to go up and watch the State of the Union is awesome. Especially when you've worked on the speech. You've seen a number of State of the Unions from the Senate side, you know, watched them on TV when you were just a young whippersnapper. And of course, you've been in the well when you were working for the president. So I thought we'd start a little bit with why is the State of the Union now important from a political perspective, especially now in an election year?
Thanks, Joe. State of the Union is important now, and especially in an election year, because to your point, it is the first place during the course of a calendar year where a president sets the course for his administration and Washington, and hopefully the country, in what he says and where he'd like the government to go. To your point, policy ideas are pulled out from cabinets, departments, agencies, all during the course of the summer and fall before State of the Union. These ideas, by the way, are also traveling concurrently at the same time with President's budget preparation. So you have this interesting two-headed monster that from the inside, the chief of staff and his team are trying to manage, getting the best ideas through the process for inclusion in the State of the Union, this public declaration of where the president and the administration would like to go in the course of the year, as well as deciding whether or not those ideas fit the constraints and the outline for the federal budget. So you're juggling both major initiatives at the same time, because both roll out, at least in the past, generally about the same time.
Yeah, but that's the first thing. Let's talk about that for a second. So the first thing that's odd here is we will not have a budget for the State of the Union for, and even for a little bit of time, correct? I mean, when do we think we will see a budget?
The administration, the Biden administration, has stated that their budget will come out on March 11th. The State of the Union is March 7th. But there's a lot of speculation that the president's budget is not locked down, it's not final, and that ultimately, at some point in the next few days, the administration will announce a delay. Nevertheless, even if they rolled out their budget, it is still incomplete because President Biden has not been able to finish most of the spending process with Congress for the previous year. So he has no idea what it is that he's already agreed to or is going to agree to with the administration before he finalizes his budget document and shoots it up to Capitol Hill. So the focus on State of the Union becomes even more pronounced in a moment where you're not going to have the budget until days, weeks, or months after the State of the Union rolls out. Generally speaking, on State of the Union, while you are trying to hit significant general themes again for the course of your year, you're also trying to make sure in an election year, you're hitting the most powerful themes for your reelection. This is the fourth year President Biden was speaking from the well of the House. And of course, he's trying to set a framework for what he wants to see as his successful reelection this summer and fall. Now, he's got several issues and challenges that any president sitting inside the Oval Office with his senior team and the speechwriters would really want to think about, first on defense and then secondly on offense. So on defense, as we all know, the issue of immigration has become incredibly significant. There's most recent Axios poll on this, which just came out last month, showed how the issue of immigration now is the top priority for nearly 30% of people polled, far outstrips any other major issue. Although questions of the economy and inflation are number two and number three up there as well. So on all three of those, the president has significant challenges. He's got a border subsumed with so far nearly 10 million illegal immigrants crossing it with no great answers about what to do to seal the border, whether or not restore President Trump's policies or do something else to grab control of the border. On the economy, we've seen the wreckage of the last 3 years with his economic nostrums and theories in action, an accelerated inflation rate that is still higher than what was forecast before he came into office, and therefore significant problems for the pocketbook. And then finally, on the question of economy overall, there's right track, wrong track is usually the proxy for that. And the polling data on right track, wrong direction is off the charts for wrong direction. I mean, it's a historic high where most of America, a vast majority of America, I should say, is convinced we're headed the wrong way. So those are three of the biggest issues he needs to deal with on defense. Now, on offense, he has a record for the past 3 years that he's going to want to bring up and try to demonstrate that he's the man who's had a set of significant accomplishments over the last 3 years and deserves re-election. I'm sure that he'll be talking about prescription drugs. I'm sure he'll be talking about health premiums. I'm sure he'll be talking about the kind of pro-consumer agenda, as they frame it, where they're going after things like various fees and charges that consumers face as they're trying to get on airplanes, use online portals and the like. Things where he's going to try to demonstrate he's on the side of the common man versus the tired old tropes and narratives that Republicans are on the side of rich people. The big X factor for him in the State of the Union is how to address the challenges in the Middle East, and in particular, what Israel is doing in Gaza. And there, I think he has significant challenge. He'd like to portray himself as a big statesman. You know, prior to October 7th, he wanted to finalize a peace agreement with Saudi Arabia, Israel, and other players in the Middle East in an effort to put the Biden stamp on President Trump's Abraham Accords. Of course, that did not happen, but he's constantly coming back to that. And that's a lot of what he's been trying to do in the region since October 7th, see if he can restore that status quo ante, the attacks, terrible attacks into Israel, in an effort again to sign this deal. And
wait, back up. Peacemaker. Back up. Status quo ante is status quo ante from the day he came in because he screwed things up, or status quo
October 6th. Great question. And on October 6th, the administration believed with confidence that it was going to be able to land a peace arrangement between Saudi Arabia and Israel with official diplomatic recognition between the two countries, and a disposition of the Iran situation that, at least by their lights, not our lights, but by their lights, was a satisfactory outcome to Iran's nuclear ambitions. That, of course, has all gone off into the tall grass after what happened on October 7th. But what he does and what he says about foreign policy and the Middle East in particular will be pretty interesting, because as we saw last week when the Michigan Democratic primary was run, a significant number of Democrat primary voters showed up to vote present or uncommitted, I guess in their lexicon, uncommitted rather than vote for Joe Biden. And about 100,000 right. voters in Michigan were Democratic voters were uncommitted, most of them in Arab majority populations in and around Dearborn and the like.
Do you know off the top of your head, do you remember off the top of your head what the margin was in Michigan last time? I mean, if he loses 100,000 votes in a primary is a ton of votes to not have. And in the general, it could be critical, right, in Michigan if it's Trump. And my understanding is when I looked at those numbers, Trump got more votes than Biden in Michigan this primary. So Trump's looking good in Michigan with this, with the setup here and the discomfort with Biden's Israel policy or Middle East policy, I should say. Now, can he pull off a coup if he were able to announce a ceasefire? We're recording this on a Friday, so this is risky for me to ask this, but you think it's possible he pulls off and announces a ceasefire and has a little bit of a win on this issue?
It's pretty clear that his administration principals, the Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor, others who handle foreign policy, are desperately trying to arrange a ceasefire. Absolutely, because he'd like to announce that on Thursday night at his State of the Union. It's unclear whether or not they can really pull that off. They had a lot of optimism going into the week before State of the Union, but that kind of cooled off as people kind of realized that the challenges of a ceasefire that would leave hostages in place and significant hostile forces still able to launch attacks against Israel were not anything that the Israelis could stomach, but also regional players were uncomfortable about as well. So I expect that his efforts will accelerate over the weekend and into early the week of the State of the Union to try to see if he can arrange something that he could call a ceasefire or a pause. But again, structurally, there are a lot of challenges to
right.
get there.
Okay. So that issue from a foreign policy perspective, I see three areas that he is going to want to hit in the State of the Union. One is going to be Russia. And he's going to call for additional funding. There's a stalled funding bill for Ukraine in Congress. So he can throw some red meat against fighting tyranny, fighting aggression, all this stuff. And he can dig at Republicans and the House for not getting a package done. He'll get a standing ovation from Democrats, certainly. He may get a fair amount of bipartisan support because there are plenty of Republicans who support that. That support as well. Then he's got, how much does he go into China before he pivots to Gaza? Or do you see Russia, then the Gaza discussion, then China? Because he's got to get some type of momentum in the foreign policy section before he hits the Gaza difficulties, because that is not going to be a pleasant, rousing section of the speech. It's a very, very difficult section of the speech for him to address and not piss off big parts of his base.
Yeah, I totally agree. So the idea of getting in and out of that section of the speech as swiftly as he can, again, this dream of pulling a ceasefire out of his hat is probably their goal number one right now, but then pivoting quickly to talk about other areas and other issues so that progressive liberal Democrats sitting in the chamber, not reacting, sitting on their hands or shaking their heads or gesturing at him, he doesn't have to endure any longer than necessary. So to your point about State of the Unions and attending, as you know, behavioral norms on the House floor have changed over the years about how to respond to the president while he's there. And so the idea that there would be shots of the president talking about the Middle East while House Democrats are not responding positively or even potentially booing him is fairly high. But I agree that beating up on Russia, talking about China in ways that are very aggressive, again, with an eye towards what are the best ways to frame these messages for a general election set of thematics, is where he would probably go on the foreign policy side. Last point on foreign policy, he, much like a president not too long ago, George H.W. Bush, prides himself on his foreign policy chops and his foreign policy accomplishments. The temptation for foreign policy to predominate his State of the Unions has been something they've been careful to try to guard against over the past 2 years, whether or not they can get him to make sure that he doesn't spend an overwhelming amount of time on foreign policy, which is kind of his instinct, will also be just an internal struggle that we won't know the answer to until we actually see the text of the speech.
Right. I think I'd also anticipate him in this Russia section doing a rousing endorsement for NATO. Two new members coming in while Biden was president, Finland and Sweden, and recently President Trump made comments that they need to belly up and pay their fair share of their NATO dues, which a number of them, they increased when Trump was president because he told them to and threatened them. And he has again threatened them that they need to do more to increase their contributions than that he would demand it as president. So Biden will have a big, strong endorsement of NATO and its history and how it's done a good job of keeping the peace and restraining Russia right up until the time that they put Crimea in their pocket and Ukraine, a chunk of Ukraine in their other pocket. And of course, it helped restrain the Soviet Union during the Cold War. But that's the other thing I'd look for is an endorsement of NATO, and it sets up a contrast with Trump.
It sure does. And part of the Biden political team's strategy appears to be, generally speaking, your reelection effort turns into a referendum on you and your first term. That can be successful. That can be more challenging for incumbent presidents. It's clear that this political team would prefer that this upcoming 2024 election not be a referendum on Joe Biden, whose numbers overall are pretty bad. And every time you go through all the various polling subgroups, you discover more problems that he has, as well as his voting coalition from 2020 being significantly diminished. But instead, try to make this, again, more of a choice conversation, which reinforces your point that I would expect in the State of the Union, either in subtle ways or very direct ways, he's going to try to draw a pretty stark contrast between himself and President Trump, and try to do that in a way that reignites some elements of his coalition and his base to try to help them begin the process of creating the ultimate reconnection of the people who voted for him in 2020 with him in 2024. It appears that that strategy, which they have tested out, I think, with some of the various things he said and events that he's had in the past 6 weeks since the Christmas break, because that strategy isn't going very well, but my guess is they can't help but double down on it with the State of the Union. And then at the aftermath of State of the Union, because remember, the president usually takes those State of the Union themes and travels and through the White House, uses those as a backdrop for a lot of aggressive messaging and politic work over the next several weeks after the State of the Union comes out. So we'll continue to see things like that and their investment in believing that, especially when it comes to the key states, somehow those sorts of thematics and ways of framing the issues will redound to their advantage and hurt President Trump, who currently leads in all the key swing states. And based on the latest analysis, if the election were held today, would win about 312 electoral votes and be reelected as president and defeat President Biden at the ballot box.
Okay, so to your point, if something on foreign policy gets cut, I think I'm going to predict it's China, that he doesn't spend a lot of time on China. Remember, Schumer had promised a China bill in 2023, which has yet to materialize. The Bidens have tried to patch things up with the Chinese and cool some of the rhetoric. There have been trips over there among U.S. senators to cool things down. Cabinet secretaries have gone over there. So I could see, you know, an oblique reference to China just on American economic competitiveness, blah, 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 but that gets cut. But they really double down. And I'm going to go, they really double down on the Russia-European issue. They ignore South America. And for the gallery, can you get Navalny's widow in the gallery, or do you put a Ukrainian orphan or some other human representation of the cost of Putin's aggression and lawlessness in the gallery for Biden to point to and get a huge bipartisan standing ovation?
There's no question that when the president decides who he wants in his section of the gallery to reference during his State of the Union, ideas like that are probably at the top of their list. Whether or not Navalny's widow, Yulia, is going to be invited and come, open question. No news on that front. But the idea that you do something related to the president's perspective on Ukraine and his approach here to try to muster as much support as he can for both the spending plan as well as whatever theory of the case they have about foreign policy when it comes to Ukraine has to be at the forefront of their consideration for whoever it is up there being recognized as the president by the president at some point during his speech.
Okay, so then let's pivot to domestic policy, which you alluded to. So you mentioned he's going to go to healthcare. He's also got the border problem, which is, you mentioned how it's the number one polling issue. And he's going to take the opportunity to try and tweak Republicans and challenge them to pass a bipartisan border security bill and funding bill, let's be clear, because the border was quiescent when he came in. He made a number of changes in immigration enforcement policy. He's got this terrible problem with the young lady at the University of Georgia getting murdered on a jog on the campus of the University of Georgia, even though she wasn't a student there anymore. And the accused had been arrested and released before, and is it definitely in the country illegally. If it turns out and that this perpetrator is the one that they've arrested, it's bad. It's a bad situation for Biden right now on the immigration crisis, and he's got to figure out how to flip it. So he'll go there. I'll try and blame Republicans for not passing the bill, even though he's made a number of different enforcement policy changes since he came in. Then he goes to healthcare. You're right. He's going to talk about drug prices and say that he's relieving seniors on drug prices. Not spoken is the number of clinical programs that pharmaceutical companies will have killed since the Inflation Reduction Act passed. Not spoken is the fact that all the money that is saved out of Medicare by the drug price setting provisions went to subsidize green energy and not bolster the trust fund for Medicare, which is slated to stop, not have enough money starting in 2027, whether it's Trump's second term or Biden's second term. It's going to need to be confronted. Next question is, does he talk about tax increases? Because does he do a soak the rich class warfare messaging here and try to announce and we have a national debt problem. Is he going to try and say that this can be solved by soaking the rich?
Great question. And certainly in his previous addresses and his previous budgets, he's had proposals to do exactly that. So I think you've got a pretty safe prediction there that in some way, shape, or form, he will haul off and try to land a haymaker on tax policy. You know, that could be something like directly calling for tax hikes. It could also be an insistence that, you know, the IRS continues to do a great job. So why are you cutting at spending? You know, all sorts of ways where, again, they're trying to reframe an agenda that is more traditional to pull their coalition back together. On health, I would also expect, in addition to your points about him bragging about his so-called accomplishments over the past 3 years, skipping over the consequences of those accomplishments, as well, given the politics and how they view their coalition, I would expect a discussion about life, abortion, and IVF. Right. I wouldn't be surprised to see him say something critical about the Alabama decision, an attempt to paint Republicans as out of step with general America on the issue of IVF, overlooking the fact that the Alabama legislature is changing the law to make sure that nobody's exposed to felony charges, and every member up in the Capitol, on the Republican side at least, have expressed very publicly their support of IVF. So he's got to try to do this. Again, his perspective and their political perspective of how to animate their coalition and their base really compels them to have a unit on this tucked into their speech, perhaps again with even a guest in the gallery, in an effort to try to somehow re-energize that right. part of his coalition.
Right. Do you, and I'm trying to picture who the guest might be. Might be too cheeky to have somebody who's a product of IVF. There are so many of them. How would any particular one be singled out as that might be one characteristic of why they'd be worthy of putting in the gallery, but they probably need something else going on. And I agree with you. I don't see how we can avoid hitting on abortion on this. It's so important to the Democratic base and motivates a lot of their voters.
He might just decide to call out Tammy Duckworth, Democratic senator from Illinois, who is a most public example on the Democratic side of somebody who utilized IVF for her two children and has been very public about her story. It's rare, but not unprecedented, that presidents call out particular members on the floor versus referencing guests up in the gallery. But it has happened in the past. Maybe that's how he puts a human face on his political exercise there.
Okay, then to your point, there's a couple other ones I want to hit. So he's going to talk about the Affordable Care Act, record enrollment numbers due to the massive subsidies when Democrats controlled the House that and the Senate that they rammed through, which will expire in either Biden or Trump's second term. So suddenly Obamacare plans, which are very expensive and oftentimes provide inadequate networks and not the greatest care, and a lot of people wouldn't even spend the amount out of their own pocket that isn't subsidized. They've larded new subsidies on to make them free for a large swath of the population. And suddenly people are like, yeah, what the hell? If it's free, I'll buy it. So he'll talk about how the fact that he lowered costs, but he's really not lowering costs. He's increasing subsidies. We don't need to dwell on that, but I don't see how he doesn't take the opportunity to tweak Republicans. And I think it's 50-50 whether he uses the term MAGA Republicans and baits them around repeal and replace and taking healthcare benefits away from people. But that seems to me a place that he would want to go.
Definitely agree with you. Again, in a world where you're trying to show that the opponent, your presidential opponent, is the real threat and the real problem, and try to paint him as the incumbent upon whom there should be a referendum rather than yourself, ideas like that are probably at the forefront of the speechwriter's mind and the policy team here as they go into the weekend, finalize the text, and start practicing with the president.
Okay, another one that I think I'm going to make a prediction here. This is risky, but I'm going to do it. Hunter's been in the news a lot lately. Hunter is, his issues are well known. I think Biden might take the opportunity to reference another son of his son Beau, who tragically died of a brain tumor far too young, and try and reinvigorate discussion of the cancer moonshot. This is something that Biden cared about as vice president. There hasn't been a lot done on it. And I could see some new effort here, either a request for additional funding or an announcement of some executive action that's about to take place. Again, what he won't reference is the number of clinical programs that drug companies have cut to fight cancer since the Inflation Reduction Act passed. So he's kind of working at cross purposes, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say we hear something about the cancer moonshot. What do you think about that idea?
I think that's a great idea and instinct. We all know that pretty much every American either has had cancer, has been friends with or related to somebody who has suffered cancer. And so to your point, this has been a multi-year effort of his. We actually, courtesy of you and others in the Trump administration, also worked pretty hard in this area. I didn't call it a cancer moonshot, but got very practical about the sorts of programs and support you would give to the private sector in trying to address the challenge of cancer. And there's been significant success in reducing mortality rates across a wide variety of cancers and increasing the quality of life and long-term survivorship of so many people who have suffered so many different cancers. But we're not at the end of this battle yet. And to your point, he has his own personal connection with this. It's been something that I've kind of been surprised that he hasn't focused on more here in his first 3 years. So it does make sense because it would touch so many different people for him to retell the story of Beau and the effort that he's making, especially because as we come to the end of this multi-month funding crisis that has gripped Washington, D.C. since last September, there will likely be good amount of resources in the current outcome of all those spending bills for continued work to address his moonshot, cancer research and cancer policies from the federal government. And to your point, he will want more in his next budget whenever he rolls it out.
Right. And, you know, just before we move on to the next one, you know, the increase in survival rates is certainly not due to better surgery techniques, although there have been tremendous advances. It's due to pharmaceutical innovation, which the Inflation Reduction Act is harming so much. Last one, this one I'm going to go... I think he might go out on a limb with, or not out on a limb, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say he talks something about artificial intelligence. He announces some type of, this is something he did with an executive order on. I don't know exactly what he would announce, but I could see some type of kickoff announcement that operationalizes various cabinet secretaries to start to make announcements in the AI arena over the coming weeks after the State of the Union. The 100-page executive order that they issued on artificial intelligence called for a number of different things to be done by the executive branch. This would also give them an opportunity to talk about American, give a hopeful view about American innovation dominating artificial intelligence like we had dominated the space race. But it would be a good, I think, optimistic view, pro-economy, pro-innovator, pro-entrepreneur, that might be able to end the speech on an up note or near the, in the second half of the speech anyway. What do you think about that?
I think there's a lot of merit to that. You know, obviously the struggle on any State of the Union is the battle between great ideas and political needs matched against the clock. Because if you know, and everybody who does politics knows, you know, you're tracking minute by minute the efficacy of the messages that you're delivering, knowing that the click off, the tune out is going to come, you know, no later than about minute 30 to minute 45 of a State of the Union. So speaking a little bit about AI and building on, you know, his instincts and some of the ideas that he's had in the past few years, as well as potential congressional action, seems a safe space for him to go while not spending too much time on it. But nevertheless, kind of to your point, putting a few more ideas out there for both what's in his budget, directing his cabinet and some of the secretaries, and seeing whether or not he can lend a little juice to the congressional effort here. It's pretty late in the congressional calendar, and certainly in an election year, it's highly unlikely that the House and Senate would be able to actually write, pass, negotiate, and see signed an AI bill. But to the extent that he can find room to give it a nudge, I think for the third limb that you're out on, it's a good limb to be squatting on.
Well, I'm not even sure I'd see him asking for legislation. I mean, he could, but I think the focus would be on what his administration is going to do. And that is the signal that we're going to start to see various cabinet secretaries announce things over the next few weeks or months. Now, what's interesting about this one is you talk about the space, and I can totally see this being a fight between the speechwriters, the various policy people. Foreign policy is going to say, oh, we need more time here. Somebody's fighting for their policy issue over there. But here's the thing, why I think AI gets in. There are so many Biden administration officials working on AI right now. This is their big thing, a huge executive order. You've got 38 agencies working on how to figure out how to regulate this stuff. You've got ARPA-H working on it, FDA, the Office of National Coordinator. I mean, nonstop. Defense, everybody's got their piece. And all these staffers, frankly, if Biden loses or wins or whatever, they all want to go work for tech companies and AI that are where they're all getting dreams about being the next Sheryl Sandberg and being a billionaire. So I'm saying those staffers are going to be fighting tooth and nail to get a reference to artificial intelligence in the State of the Union. And that is a key reason why I'm saying, with no evidence whatsoever, that there's going to be a reference to it in the State of the Union.
Joe, I take your point. And even though it sounds kind of dark, people fighting for their next job during their current job is not something we haven't seen in previous administrations, that's for sure. One thing quickly before we go, of course, is while the president commands the rostrum and has the State of the Union to himself, there's always a response. Since the mid-1960s, we've consistently had a response from the other party. This year's State of the Union response will be given by freshman Senator Katie Britt, who was elected to the Senate a couple of years ago. She's 42 years old, mom of a couple of kids, served time as a staffer in the United States Senate, then went back and ran a large pro-business operation in the state of Alabama before joining the Senate race, clearing the primary, and ultimately being elected with President Trump's support. She is both a great and powerful messenger, very direct in her priorities. And I think it will be a refreshing change to see Katie Britt, young, vibrant, alive, talking about the Republican agenda versus elderly and certainly physically challenged president who, even if he's adjusted everything he needs to adjust to be able to stand up and go through the State of the Union during the evening of Thursday, March 7th, will still be under a lot of physical stress. And as we've all seen in the past few weeks, a real different set of difficulties in movement, mobility, hearing, and the like. Even though he had his medical team conduct a physical examination and give him a clean bill of health, I think as you look at polls and underneath the polls, all the sub-data and a lot of the verbals, the amount of concern that the public has about the president's physical capacity to command this job and do this job has grown significantly in the past several months, as well as opening questions about his capacity across the board to serve as president of the United States. And Senator Britt will be a strong counterpoint to the problems that President Biden has on that front.
What do you think she's going to focus on? Inflation, the world is less safe since Biden came. What does she hit?
Yeah, I think those are some of the key thrusts that you'll hear. The response is definitely not as long as the State of the Union presentation. Right. And usually attempts to focus on framing the out-of-party's powerful agenda in ways that connect most directly, most quickly with people who have open ears and are curious about what it is that American voters really want to know as they go into the election booth. That having been said, given how much in this day and age social media really plays a role, the idea of the speech content in and of itself is important enough, but more critically in this day and age is what can you pull out of it for those snippets, for those memes, for those 30, 10, 5 second
right.
clunks on Instagram, on X, you know, fill in the blank, all the various platforms. And so both sides will be looking for those little snippets that they can market, and as well as, you know, whatever the physical reaction in the chamber will be. So I would expect that for Senator Britt, there's also a much more thoughtful approach, not just to the contents, but okay, how in the current social media environment in which we live, this can be utilized for months to come. Counter the president, who courtesy of his generation and how he approaches things in a much longer form, will probably be a little resistant to incorporating things that are able to be utilized that way by his political party, the Democratic National Committee and the like, his campaign, his reelect campaign, as they go about doing their job.
Yeah, a lot at stake for both President Biden and Katie Britt. I would assume if she gives a blockbuster, there will be a boomlet of discussion as for her to be a potential VP pick for all the reasons you mentioned. If she doesn't do well, you'll see some discussion. And it's very difficult to give the response. They frequently don't go well. The person who gives the response is frequently panned. It's just a tough spot to be in. So that's my prediction on her. Either it's a thumbs up and we get discussion of her as a potential VP pick for President Trump, or if she stumbles and doesn't deliver what she could, doesn't live up to expectations and her potential, then I think that dies down and she's got and would probably need to regroup and would be out of the running. And for Biden, I think a lot of people watching this are going to be nervous because of what they've seen about him falling, stumbling, physically falling down, but also stumbling over his words, which is kind of nerve-wracking to watch anybody who's elderly function in that environment. I mean, it would be high risk if he were to ad lib and go off script. Do you see him doing that at all?
I think he will have that temptation to ad lib. As you know, once he was a pretty good debater and could be fairly sharp and quite cutting. But in this environment, I'm sure his team is being pretty aggressive about stay on the teleprompter, stay on script. Let's not wander off and turn ourselves into a moment where everybody's going to have to work to try to clean it up afterwards. They wouldn't be that blunt. You're never that blunt with any president. But that's definitely going to be instinct that his senior team and his communicators in particular are going to have.
Okay, I got one last crazy question for you, and then I'll let you say anything nuts that you want to say, not that you ever say anything crazy. But the last question I've got for you is, what Biden went and did a trip unannounced to Walter Reed just this past week. So is there a tell in the speech where Eric Ulan might say, oh my gosh, he's not going to run? That is to say, is if he's overly conciliatory and nicer than he has been in his rhetoric, if he makes reference to something, if he's particularly nostalgic about his career, or is that nuts? There's no way he's going to be dissuaded at this point at full speed ahead, and absent a catastrophic medical incident, he will not be stepping down and will not be replaced until November?
I think it's a great question. And absolutely, kind of to your point, those are both illustrative ways where you kind of want to stop and pause, other than the explicit LBJ style approach to, hey, I've decided I'm not doing this again, which was, of course, a significant surprise at the end of March in 1968. So we'll all be watching the tea leaves here in terms of the content. If it's brisk and peppery and leans in, and like I said, tries to draw a significant contrast between how awesome he is and how terrible President Trump is, and is engineered to try to evoke as much Democratic applause from members there down in the chamber of the House, yeah, it will continue to be full steam ahead. No signals changed. He's going to be the nominee and intends to fight this out in the fall.
Any concluding remarks, Eric? things to look for, things to make it. You want to put a bet on whether or not he mentions artificial intelligence or not?
Sure. If you got a little Bitcoin, always happy to bet.
With you on that. Is that a plug? Oh, I didn't realize you represent the Bitcoin.
If only, right? No, I don't represent Bitcoin. I just thought since we're AI, let's talk about virtual currency. I think hopefully we've given people good food for thought, Joe, and had a great conversation here in our unique and erratic style of discussion about what the heck's actually going on for State of the Union. We'd like to thank our sponsor for the conversation today, Survivors for Solutions, our great producer, John C.Z. Swartacki, our distribution partner, Big Wig Media, and our production team, Evergreen. On behalf of DCEKG, this is Eric Euland with host Joe Grogan. Thanks for listening. We'll be talking.